Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning. This is case 824-0251. I hope I pronounced this correctly. Lernitz versus RAM Mutual Insurance Company. So all parties are aware. Counsel for the appellant will have 15 minutes. Counsel for respondent will have 15 minutes, and there'll be 5 minutes of rebuttal. This matter is being recorded, streaming live and recorded tomorrow, but private recordings are prohibited. Whenever counsel for the appellant, you're ready, just please begin. And again, for the record, identify yourself in a loud, clear voice.
Understood. Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. Mihailo Babovich, it's MIHAJLOBABOVIC, appear on behalf of plaintiff appellant Mark Lehnert. Now, the case we have here before the court is fundamentally an insurance dispute, right? Appellant had an insurance policy with respondent RAM Mutual Insurance Company, and that insurance policy covered various property damage to appellant's property. Now, on June 17th of 2021, appellant's property suffered hail damage. Appellant duly notified respondent for the damage, who opened a claim. The parties attempted to resolve the claim, but were unable to do so. They disagreed as to the extent, the amount of the loss. Accordingly, the appellant filed the present lawsuit, right? And this lawsuit alleges that respondent breached the policy because the respondent failed to appropriately adjust the claim, that the respondent failed to pay amounts that were legitimately due and owing under the insurance policy to the appellant.
Mr. Babovich, can I just ask a point of clarification? We don't have a record of the insurance contract in this case. This is brought as a breach of contract action, which typically has a 6-year statute of limitations in the state of Minnesota. Is there some lesser limitations period that's part of the contractual agreement of the parties?
Yes, Your Honor. So
is it a 2-year?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. And so on June 15th of 2023, 2 days before that 2-year statute of limitations ran, appellant brought this action. And appellant commenced this action utilizing the substitute service mechanism provided for in Minnesota statute section 45.028. And that's
Does
really
the record reflect why appellant didn't directly serve the insurance company?
There's no real record of that, Your Honor. Appellant is under the impression, it's appellant's position that he was entitled to utilize the substitute service mechanism provided for in 45.028.
Okay.
And so we have this statute, which is really the crux of this appeal. And quickly, I'll touch on subdivision 2 of 45.028, which provides for the process through which a prospective plaintiff completes service if they are entitled to do so via substitute service. And I don't believe there's any real dispute as to whether or not appellant successfully utilized the mechanism. However, it is disputed that appellant was ever authorized to complete service in this manner, and thus that the service was ineffective. So the portion of 45.028 that really is at issue in appeal is subdivision 1A, and that is where the dispute lies. And so the issue on appeal to be decided is what that statute precisely means. And maybe more specifically than that, we're talking about what the term brought under means as used in the context of section 45.028 subdivision 1A. Now, the district court dismissed the appellant's complaint for lack of proper service. And in doing so, its analysis focuses on whether or not the appellant had a right to bring various statutory causes of action. Specifically, the court was ruling on Minnesota statute section 72A.201 and 60A.0811. And its analysis focuses entirely on, hey, can this plaintiff bring a private cause of action under these statutes? So it found, hey, 72A.201, we have case law that says there's no private cause of action for that statute. So no, you can't bring a cause of action. 60A.0811, similar thing. Hey, this is an interest statute. You can't bring a cause of action for it. And thus the court said, well, you didn't comply with you didn't meet the requirements to utilize substitute service and dismiss the case. Now, that was the error, right? The district court's analysis was whether or not the plaintiff had a right to bring claims made actionable by these statutes.
So, counsel, I agree with you that the issue here is whether the claims were brought under the listed chapters. And that's an issue of statutory construction that we review de novo. Would you agree with that?
I do.
Okay. And so the original complaint alleged two claims, breach of contract and declaratory judgment, neither of which reference any of those chapters, correct?
That's correct.
And then the amended complaint also includes two claims, breach of contract and declaratory judgment. And I think you'd probably agree that the claim brought under is a term of common legal parlance.
I would agree.
And isn't the natural reading of brought under in that context, isn't the natural reading of that that the claim must state a cause of action under one of those statutes? Or that one of those statutes must supply the cause of action that is being brought
Your
in
Honor,
order for the suit proceeding or action to be brought under one of those statutes.
I would agree with you that the colloquial use of the term brought under is to say you are bringing a claim that's made actionable by a statute. But we're not dealing with colloquial usage of a term in this situation, right? We're dealing with statutory interpretation. And so what we have, what we know, is that we have the canon against surplusage, right? Which tells us, hey, if the legislature uses two different terms within the same statutory framework, that distinction is meaningful, right? And so in subdivision 1A of section 45028, we have two clauses, right? Clause one talks about this notion that when a person engages in conduct that's prohibited or made actionable by the statutory provisions enumerated, that that conduct is the equivalent of an appointment of service of an appointment of the Commissioner of Commerce as the person's attorney to receive service and process. The second clause of subdivision 1A discusses essentially the limit of that appointment, right? And that says that that appointment is effective to any non-criminal suit action, suit or action, excuse me, which is based on that conduct and brought under these chapters. Now, again, I do agree that the colloquial use of the term brought under is to say, hey, this is a claim made actionable by statute. However, the way that the courts interpret statutes fundamentally has to give these two things different meanings. If the legislature.
Correct. And doesn't your interpretation basically render the language brought under meaningless? Because, as I understand your argument, there's no requirement that a claim be brought under any of those chapters. It's just that there be conduct that is prohibited by or made actionable by those chapters. In other words, it seems to me your argument in, as set forth in your brief gives brought under the same meaning as the conduct clause.
I would phrase it as this. I would say that the term brought under in this context is to say that you are alleging a violation of statute. And if that violation of statute supports your cause of action, right, it predicates it, whether that be a declaratory judgment action, whether that be a breach of contract, a tort, what have you, right? It doesn't fundamentally, it doesn't matter what this what the claim is called. But in
How
this
does wait. Can you step back a second?
mm-hmm.
You said, how does that equate to bringing an action under those chapters?
Because what you're doing is you are asserting, hey, you breached a contract by violating statute, right? You
But
conducted.
that's not what your complaint, you're not bringing an action under those that statute. You're just referencing the statute in your complaint, but you're not bringing an action under it.
That's correct. We are not asserting a claim that is entitled breach of Minnesota statute 72A, whatever, right? The claim is a breach of contract, right? That's what it is. I'm not going to try to argue around that.
Can I just follow up on Judge Cochran's question?
Sure.
My challenge, my personal challenge, Mr. Babovich, is I don't know what your definition of brought under is. I mean, you've kind of given us a good explanation as to how you think that the statute as a whole operates, but what I'm looking for is what does that term mean? And if there's two reasonable meanings, then we're dealing with an ambiguity, but if there's not two reasonable meanings, we're not. So
Sure.
tell, what does that term mean?
Sure. The term brought under in this context means that you are bringing a claim asserting conduct that violates a statute.
And where is the claim in the complaint that you allege via, I mean, because the claims in the complaint are a deck action and a breach of contract.
That's correct.
So where's the claim that you have asserted that there's a violation of the statute in the complaint?
I understand. So it would be the breach of contract action. And I guess I'd direct the court to the original complaint, paragraph 13, which is this idea that, or this allegation, excuse me, that respondent failed to appropriately adjust the loss and approve and pay amounts due and owing to plaintiff under the policy. And I would argue that under a notice pleading standard that that alleges a violation of Minnesota Statute 72A 201. Subdivision 5, paragraph 3, which is the Unfair Claims Practices Act, and prohibits an insurer from refusing to pay elements of a claim for which there's no good faith dispute. So it's our position that that allegation sufficiently puts the respondent on notice that they legitimately owe money under the policy and that they've failed to adjust properly, meaning that they failed to argue with good faith or failed to withhold payment with a good faith dispute.
Does it though? I
So,
mean, oh, go ahead, Judge Cochran.
no, you go ahead. I can circle back.
I mean, it does it though? I mean, it seems to me like if you're really putting the insurer on notice that their contract is void or voidable for being in violation of a statute, that that would be the subject of the deck action, which you would be pleading, which is not the subject of the deck action.
Sure, but the claim is not to say, hey, this is a voidable contract. This is a claim saying I've been damaged by your failure to properly adjust the claim, right? I've been damaged by your failure to pay amounts that are legitimately due and owing under the policy.
So I want to circle back to your definition of brought under, and I think you stated that brought under is bringing a claim asserting conduct that violates one of the listed statutes, and I think in your brief you say something similar, but how do you, what legal support do you have for your proposed definition? And then I have a follow-up question for you after that.
Sure, Your Honor. I'm just quickly searching for it. So there's not, you know, this is not a highly litigated term, right? And likely it's because it is a colloquially used term. I suppose our legal position would be to say that there has to be a fundamental distinction here, right? And
But isn't that distinction that brought under means you have to allege a cause of action based on one of those statutes versus simply conduct that's prohibited by one of those statutes? Because the first clause deals with conduct that's prohibited or made actionable by one of those statutes. So that's talking about what the conduct is. And then the second part is bringing an action. So here you have the conduct, and then you have actually bringing the lawsuit and or the proceeding. Because I think one thing that's important to recognize here is in the statute it's referring to more than just a lawsuit. It refers to a suit, action, or a proceeding, and a proceeding could be an enforcement proceeding. Some of those statutes, like 155A, authorizes an enforcement proceeding by the regulator. And subdivision two, I think, recognizes that a proceeding doesn't have to, could be even brought by the commissioner himself or herself or themselves as an enforcement action, because subdivision two talks about the plaintiff who may be the commissioner in an action or a proceeding instituted by the commissioner. So I think when you read the statute as a whole, it's clear that brought under is talking about bringing an action pursuant to one of those chapters. not simply alleging conduct that violates one of those chapters. So help me understand why I'm wrong and where what the foundation, legal foundation for your definition is, which I think is different than what I've articulated.
Sure. So again, when we're interpreting a statute, we look at it and say, hey, if the legislature wanted the same thing, they'd use the same words. So in the second clause, if they intended that the restriction be to claims made actionable by statutes, it's our position that they would have written as much, right? They would have said, hey, this service of process applies to any
But
suit.
that's talking about the conduct. It's not talking about bringing an action. It's talking about what conduct is within the scope of the statute. And then the second part is actually bringing the suit, action, or proceeding. So I don't think it renders it meaningless, as you're suggesting. I
Sure.
think,
My
in other words,
suggestion.
I think only my only the interpretation, I think your interpretation renders that broad under language meaningless.
Understand. I see that I'm out of time. I'll just quickly answer the question. But
Yes, please, please do.
okay. The if the legislative intent was to mean the same thing, then they would have written the same thing, right? They would have written the statute to say the service of process applies in any proceeding which is based on that conduct and made action and made actionable by these subdivisions, right? Because made actionable by is a very, very specific term. And so I think that if the legislative intent was to mean the same thing, what the canons of interpretation tells us is they would have used the same language. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll now hear for counsel for the respondent, please.
Thank you, Your Honors. John Neal on behalf of Ram Mutual Insurance Company. The real crux here, I agree, is the term broad under. I think both parties have narrowed their briefings to that issue. But I do want to back up for a moment and understand kind of the context of what we start with. And that is when a party utilizes substitute service, like Mr. Lennertz did here. Courts strictly construe the jurisdictional requirements to ensure that service is properly made. And in this case, Chapter 45.028 is a substitute service statute. It does allow service to be made upon the Commissioner of Commerce, but two things have to be met first in order for that service to be effective. One is the defendant or the proposed defendant must engage in conduct prohibited or made actionable by the enumerated statutes. I don't think there's any dispute as to that language. And the second part is must bring an action based on the conduct and brought under one of the enumerated statutes. Well, the two claims that Mr. Lennertz brought here were a breach of contract claim, a common law breach of contract claim, and a declaratory judgment action, asking the court to construe the rights of the parties under the contract. Neither of those two claims fall within the listed or enumerated statutes of 45.028.
Did
Accordingly,
the amendment of the complaint to reference 72A cure that situation? In other
no.
words, does that amount to bringing an action under one of the chapters that's listed because 72A.201 falls within the range of those statutes?
Sure, Your Honor, the answer is no for three reasons. First is the court never obtained jurisdiction over the original complaint, and therefore the amended complaint is really a nullity. The court never had jurisdiction to even consider it. Second, the case law as briefed indicates that even if the amended complaint were accepted, the relation back rule doesn't apply. And third, and most importantly, is exactly what the trial court found, which is the Unfair Claims Practice Act, 72A.201, does not create a private right of action. In which case, even if it's asserted, the court notes we would have dismissed it anyway. The court would have dismissed it anyway for failure to assert a claim upon which relief can be granted, which is another basis for a Rule 12 dismissal. And so, no, that did not cure the problem.
Hypothetically, would a litigant have the ability to assert a declaratory judgment action against an insurer that a contract or conduct by the insurer was contrary to Section 72? Would that be a cause of action?
I don't think under the declaratory judgment statute, because that
Well, it
here.
would be a declaration that something is happening in violation of a statute.
Yeah, so I've looked at the listed statutes, the enumerated statutes, to see, okay, what claims can a plaintiff bring here that would allow them to utilize the substitute service? And there, for example, within 65A.01, subdivision 3, there's cancellation provisions. An insurance carrier is prohibited from canceling policies for certain, well, there's really only a certain number of bases upon which they can cancel. If they don't do that correctly, that would give rise to a violation of that statute in which a claim could be brought.
But that would be a damages claim. So I mean, the point that I'm getting at is I think the district court's order and the argument that you're making are that these claims are not claims from which a private right of action for damages can lie, but does that necessarily foreclose a private right of action that some conduct or some provision of a contract is contrary to statute under the Declaratory Judgment Act? You see the distinction that I'm drawing here?
Yeah, I understand. I think I understand the question. My initial response is, well, that was never pled or argued by Mr. Lennertz here, so I don't think that applies. Maybe in the right context, that is a question that could require some further briefing. But again, it was never raised. So,
That's fair. I appreciate that. Thank you.
yes, Your Honor.
Camille, what is your definition of broad under? I think you included your proposed definition in your brief, but can you discuss that with us and help us understand the legal basis for your proposed definition?
Yeah, Your Honor. So we identified three cases within our brief where that court, the courts, including our Supreme Court, has looked at that term "brought under." And what it means is to specifically bring a claim under that statute. You know, and that's fundamental not only in civil law but in criminal law. So the party that's being the allegations are being alleged against has proper notice of what's being brought against them. And so it means specifically that the claim is brought under that statutory section. I mean, it's not uncommon for plaintiffs to allege statutory violations that can give rise to damage claims. And that's what the statute means. Now, this not this panel, but the Court of Appeals in the past, in the Wandersee case we cited from 2022, the court said a plain reading. A plain reading of the statute requires an allegation that defendant engage in conduct prohibited or made actionable by the enumerated statutes. So
But
we do have some.
that goes to the first clause, which is when a person engages in conduct prohibited or made actionable by the listed statutes. And then the subdivision one goes on to say that that service can be made on the commissioner based on that conduct for, well, that I should just read the full language, but that in any non-criminal suit, action, or proceeding against the person which is based on that conduct and brought under the list of chapters. So brought under is a separate requirement from simply having conduct that's prohibited by or made actionable by those chapters. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree. And I agree the Wandersee Court did not touch on the word brought under, but I think the same reasoning, though, from that decision would apply. I mean, the statute is, there's no ambiguity to this statute whatsoever. I mean, brought under is a pretty plain term that we in the legal community are accustomed to. And we
So
have a
why, but going back to Mr. Babovich's argument, why isn't simply alleging conduct that violates one of those statutory provisions as part of a breach of contract claim sufficient to bring an action under the one of those statutory provisions.
So two things. One, it's a breach of contract claim, so it's not brought under a statutory provision. And two, the statutory provisions in and of themselves don't give rise to technically a breach of contract claim. I mean, breach of contract claim is based on breaching some terms or obligations within the contract, not some outside conduct that's prohibited by a statute. So I think that's the distinction why those two don't dovetail together. And I think that's consistent with, well, the Hadler versus White Bear Lake decision that the Court of Appeals issued in 1998. And then we also have the Openchek case, which is a Minnesota District Court federal case. But the reasoning is the same. And again, we're talking about substitute service. And the court has historically required strict compliance with those statutory requirements, and that just wasn't done here. I would like to briefly touch on the other two statutes that were referenced. 65A.08, that's the valued policy law. That was never raised in the trial court, that's not properly before this court. Second, it was never mentioned in the complaint. And third, there were no claims brought under that statute again. The new argument being raised for the first time with the Court of Appeals is the Minnesota statute 68.0811, which is the 10% interest on judgments. A number of reasons why that's inapplicable. This was raised in the trial court, but it appears to have been abandoned. There isn't any briefing on it, and nor should there be, because that statute applies to commercial or professional policies. That's not this policy. And again, there's no claims brought under the statute. And again, it's not an independently actionable claim as the trial court had determined. I see I still have 4 minutes, but I would waive the balance of my time unless the court has any further questions.
I don't believe we do. Thank you, Mr. Neal. Counsel for the appellant, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, I guess I'll circle back to my definition of the term brought under. And previously, I was asked for some support for our contention. I would point the court to case cited in our initial briefing, which is Steele Co. v. Citizens for a Better Environment, which is a U.S. Supreme Court case from 1998.
I looked at that case, counsel, and I think the language that you quote there is specific to the statute, the environmental statute that's at issue in that case, and that environmental statute specifically talks about requirements. So I'm not sure that that U.S. Supreme Court case is really that relevant to the analysis here. It's really tethered to the language of the environmental statute at issue.
Well, much like the term brought under in this statute should be tethered to itself, right? And so
right, but I think when you look at, I have to find where it is in your brief, you have that, but it's on page
It's 10 to 11.
Yes. So you say section, you say in referring to actions brought on, you're quoting some language from that case, 111.406C means suits contending that section 104.6A contains a certain requirement. 104.6A provides a private cause of action. So it's basically a suit brought under alleging a claim under that. And in order to allege a claim under 104.6A, you have to allege that a certain requirement wasn't met. So it's all in basically in line with the interpretation that I was, the alternative interpretation that I was proposing. I don't think it really supports your analysis.
Understood. Well, our position just has to be that it's different, right? And the legislature just wouldn't have used it. That's black letter law, right? If the legislative language in statutes is a very meaningful thing, And I understand that they're used in slightly different contexts, these two phrases, made actionable by and brought under, but they're used within the exact same statutory framework and in the exact same text and referencing the exact same statutes. And given that, I mean, there has to be some distinction. And I understand that.
So, assuming we were to agree with you, is the amended complaint even properly considered?
I would say that it is, given that if the issue is merely a technical one, right? One where, excuse me, one where the issue is, hey, you should have just used the statutory buzzword, right? If the issue was, oh, well, you needed to say 72A.201 and you didn't have that, I would argue that's purely technical.
But the language that you added to the amended complaint related to tolling, which wasn't at all at issue in the original complaint, and it wasn't at issue because at the time the original complaint was filed, it was within the 2-year window. And I think the language that you were concerned about with regard to a tolling agreement relates to, the
And
fact that
equitable
this amended
estoppel.
complaint is filed after the 2-year period.
Sure. And so our position would be that we'd be entitled to relate it back.
But I guess what I'm wondering is how does the addition of 72A in your amended complaint really relate back to the original complaint because it wasn't what the original complaint was grounded in?
Was the same type of conduct, I guess, that's violating it, right? It's the same Unfair Claims and Practices Act, and I guess I'd point to some of the authorities cited by the respondent here in the Oprenchek case. In note 7, the case talks about, or the court talks about, situations where the plaintiff's claims could fall under these statutes, and of course that was an insurance case, so they found, well, hey, you're not arguing about. Or that was, excuse me, that was an employment case. So they're saying, hey, well, you're not arguing about insurance policies. But I think that case and the Wandersee case, both to some extent, stand for the proposition to say, hey, well, you could make allegations under a deck action or a breach of contract action that would satisfy 45028. And point the court to page 3 in the Wandersee case, where the court discusses this idea that the declaratory judgment action claims, because there was no allegation that Ram had engaged in any prohibited or actionable conduct, but not because they had failed to bring a claim under the enumerated statutes. And so I do think that there's some authority that the courts have previously opined as to that issue, but have just never reached this specific issue. And I see my time's up. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for the appellant. Thank you, counsel, for the respondent. We will be issuing our decision in 90 days. The matter is submitted.